Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Questlove Supreme. I'm Questlove here with Laia, Sugar Steve, Unpayville, and Fontigolo. Hey, yes, dude, how bad do we miss our theme song?
No.
It's sometimes just playing in just hum it a little bit. It's
Suprema roll call.
Yeah, it's killing me inside that we're doing all these great episodes.
Because he would have killed it.
Yeah, with no roll call. It's killing me inside.
Maybe we ask CeeLo to send one later.
We got to think of a way to do a social distance roll call. Exactly. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our guest today, legendary gentleman. I know this is kind of, I always get weird when I'm like, I have to introduce people that I really, really, really know, not like people that I just admire on television or whatever. But
exactly.
Yeah, but
5-time Grammy winner, the most transformative MC in the game. I mean, yeah. I'm sorry. I'm just
yes. Our
run
guest.
I take that.
Yes. Multiple Grammys. I will say even more, like one of my favorite singers living today. I mean, I could name maybe like four of them that I really like, not even people that are able to sing, but people that are able to move you when they sing. Mm. Not to mention, very effective MC. Most people forget that as 1/4 of the legendary Goody Mob from Atlanta. What more can I say? Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to Questlove Supreme, the one and only Thomas DeCarlo Calloway, a.k.a. Yeah. CeeLo Green. I did not know your middle name was DeCarlo.
Yes, yes. Greetings, kings and queens. How are you?
What's going on, brother? How you feel?
We good.
What's up, brother?
What's good?
Where are you right now, man?
I'm in Atlanta. Technically, I'm an hour outside of Atlanta. I'm out in Peachtree City. I live out in the country out here.
So you never left Atlanta. Did you ever live in LA for a little while, or were you always in Atlanta?
I did. When I was out there doing The Voice, I was there for about 5 years, and then I left LA, and then I went and lived in Las Vegas for 2 years, and then Miami for 2 years, and now I'm back in Atlanta.
Okay, gotcha. I think the last time I saw you, it was a minute ago. Me and Pooh, we ran into you outside of Bossa Nova in LA.
Yeah.
It was late night. That. It was at the show.
And I recognize y'all. Y'all act like y'all was surprised that I recognize, you know what I'm saying? I see you. I said, look at the homeboy.
Was you say,
hey, bro, I ain't know. Yeah, I never assumed that, you know, cats would know who we were. So, but I guess if you see us together, that's when you can kind of do the math. But,
oh, no.
But yeah, man.
Quest would be able to affirm that, you know, I'm a real head, you know, so yeah. You could pop quiz me just about any topic. I should pan out pretty good.
That's what's up.
Yeah.
What's up?
What's up, OG Quest? What you doing?
Chilling here on a ranch. A little sad now because just got news today that my four of my poultry friends have passed away. Apparently, a raccoon discovered how to get inside the hen.
Oh.
See, now Steve is laughing right now. For those who don't know, I'm quarantining. I quarantined upstate New York. You know, when I started, it was 5 chickens and 6 baby ducks. The baby ducks are now as big as Debo on Friday, so now they bully the chickens.
That's a big
meanwhile,
duck.
That's meanwhile, a big duck. Raccoons and foxes have found inventive ways to come and eat the chickens. So,
Wait, how do we know that it's CeeLo? How do we know that it's foxes and raccoons that are murdering the chickens?
Because we can clearly see who it is. Yeah.
Well, I'm just saying, ever since you showed up to the ranch, chickens are mysteriously disappearing.
Whatever, Steve. Anywho. So
that's dope, Quest. I'm on a ranch too. We have a ranch property out here in Atlanta.
You got animals?
No, because the property, we've been kind of using it as a vacation rental property and Airbnb because I haven't been living in Atlanta primarily. When we first got this property about 12 years ago, they threw a couple of horses in, you know, as a package, but I didn't, you know, I had to, you know, decline because, you know, first then I did my diligence and I found out that the horses are very expensive to take care of. Yes. And then of course I just didn't have staffing or anything to do anything like that. So I was like, nah, thank you. I appreciate the gesture, but no thanks. So no animals.
Yeah, definitely taking care of animals on a farm is a full-time job.
How about that for a full circle moment though? Talking to South Philly and Atlanta over here. Now y'all both on ranches.
Now we all are farming.
Never thought the hip hop would take it this far.
what part of Atlanta were you born in? See?
Southwest Atlanta.
Swats.
Swats, the South.
Okay, so explain to me what Swats is.
Southwest
Atlanta, too strong.
You can only claim one place. Don't start homework. Claiming everything.
Sorry. Okay, so Southwest Atlanta is it's like a four street kind of conglomerate. I mean, that starts at Campbellton Road, which is where Tyler Perry's first television studio was based, right around the corner from Greenbrier Mall. I grew up on that street. It was a vacant Delta building that he converted into his first studios, and then he ultimately went on to buy Fort McPherson, which was an abandoned army base. But anyway, wow. So yeah, no, it's Campbellton Road on up to Bankhead Highway, which is where T.I. Is from. T.I. and then rest in peace, Shouty Low. They represent Bankhead. So like, it's just like a four street parallel. And you know, I mean, East Point is one street over, you know, where Big Gip is from Goody Mob. And then, you know, you keep going on that. Then College Park is another few miles over. That's Ludacris, that's 2 Chainz and those guys.
Didn't Diallo say that he went to school with CeeLo?
He went to, Chaka? I don't know if he went to, Diallo Riddle, I think he said he went to Benjamin Mays.
Yeah, I know Diallo.
Yeah, he went to Benjamin Mays. Me and him work on a show together, Sherman Showcase.
I know Sherman Showcase.
I've known Diallo since we were kids.
Oh wow!
Wow!
Okay. Yeah. I was trying to figure out. I knew that Diallo went to school with someone notable, but I didn't know if it was you or Big Boy. It was you.
Yeah. Okay. That's a fact. We went to Mays and Big Boy and Dre. They went to Tri-Cities High School.
Okay.
So Candy from Escape went to Tri-Cities with them.
So in growing up, first of all, are you the only child, or do you have other siblings?
Yeah, I have one other sibling. I have an older sister, but kind of like having an older sister is basically like being like the only child still. Yeah. she did not like me when we were kids. I was locked out of her room, you know. And
wait, how much older was she?
2 years older.
Oh, so she's okay. So she's now. Like,
yeah, no, we're really close now. She's like, she's my realtor. She's my property manager, project manager, co-founder of our foundation. She's a dynamic woman. Yes, she is.
We saw her on Unsung. She's beautiful too. Mm-hmm.
So, in growing up, what was the musical environment like in your household? Because I imagine with that voice that someone in that house had to have been singing, or was that?
Yeah, both my mother and father were ministers, but I wasn't just completely like sheltered. You know what I mean? Spiritual or gospel, even though I spent a considerable amount of time in church and around gospel music, which I love. I love the Clark sisters, Leon Patillo, you know, even Amy Grant, you know what I mean?
Damn, you said Leon Patillo.
Amy Grant.
Yeah. Amy Grant.
Whoa, you said Leon Patillo.
That's, you know, I'm real. That's how you know I'm real.
Oh, and my God.
And of course, the Whinings, you know what I mean?
So yeah. That means Christian radio was on in your house all the time.
It was.
It had to be.
But then I had that secular side of me because my mother had friends outside of that. You know, church is like a little social network. You know what I mean? So like she had friends that she did business with outside of her church community. And one of them was a legendary radio personality by the name of Ali Pat. So mm-hmm. you could research him and, you know, him and Hosea Williams. Like they were friends of my mother's when I was young. And so I would go to the radio station and he gave me a box full of 45s. And so I would listen to stuff like, you know, Johnny Taylor and ZZ Hill and BB King and Bobby Blue Land. Yeah. So like I love the blues growing up too. The gospel was like the blues almost. Like it was you know, there was a parallel that you know that connected the two, if you ask me.
How old were you when you recognized your, I want to know at what age was your voice developed?
I can remember, man, who sings, Gene Chandler. It's a song called The Rainbow. And okay. we used to sing this, you know, in the family talent shows in front of the big floor model TV in the den. So it was this song. And then it was, Jackie Wilson's Dog and Me Around. So
right.
So if you notice, I can imitate him. So like, that's how I learned how to sing, because you know that's that first form of flattery. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And then it's just imitating.
And then you filter it into, you know, what's to become your own living experience in the way that, you know, you interpret life. You know, or you know, and then it's kind of reiterated in its own, you know, new, and you know, it's like a hybrid theory of something. So like, no, I Jackie.
So you
Wilson
weren't like traditionally
person.
Singing in church and.
No,
like...
well, I did a couple of solos in church. I was mostly kind of fascinated with the band. We had I went to Grace Covenant Baptist Church. That was our first family church in Atlanta. And the band was just fantastic. You know what I mean? And so I would sit right in the pew right behind the band. It was set to the far left of the you know, the church. And I would just sit there and watch the drummer. So at that time, I wanted to play drums. You know what I mean? And then I was always fascinated with the organ. I guess it's that big joint. It's not the Oberheim, but it's like, you know, it's that big three-level joint.
Mm-hmm. Hammond.
You know, and I always loved the organ. It struck a chord with me because I'm a Gemini. So therefore I have that duality of, you know, they say half mortal, half God kind of thing. So, you know, so it sounded really righteous, and then it sounds really evil in one way too. So like, to me, that's like the ultimate like instrument. So it really struck a nerve with me, and it kind of like, you know, opened me up where I can kind of, you know, identify with different energies in song. You know what I mean? So I could tell if something had something intentful or something was really real about something. You know what I mean? I hope I'm saying that right.
It's funny to hear you say it, you describe it like that, because as a kid going to church, like the organ to me was also an instrument. Like it could sound beautiful in some ways, but then it could also sound kind of ominous. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
so exactly.
Like, when they would play like on Scooby-Doo, the theme, the boom, boom, boom.
So that was
kind of like my relationship to gospel music as well. Like it was I saw it as something that was like my grandparents' music, and it was in our household, it was kind of like you had to listen to it. You know, we ain't gonna listen to no rap today, cut, we just playing gospel. It was almost like a punishment, but right. In that was where I found, you know, Mighty Clouds of Joy, Jackson Southern Airs, like all the quartet gospel. Like
Mighty
that
Clouds
was,
of Joy.
Yeah, that
this
was my
is
stuff.
Just a rehearsal when we get to heaven to go to real estate. Yeah, come on, I know that. And then you got Willie Mitchell, you know what I mean? Like who did?
Yeah, High Records, yeah.
Yeah, it's just, it's derivative of that church, you know, organ background, like, and it just made all of that Al Green music just sound so familiar, so warm. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah, that's why Al Green is the best. Okay.
It just hit me. You're born in 1975, which makes you 6 years old in 1981.
Mm-hmm.
What can you describe to me, or at least from your point of view, because the one thing that I knew the most about Atlanta, at least growing up, was about the child murders.
I was just about to say that.
Yeah. That occurred down there. So what was your childhood into, especially in those early years? Was it like you had to be inside 24/7? Like how did that affect, at least with the murders hanging over everyone's heads in Atlanta with black children? How did that affect your childhood for those early years?
Well, I lived just moments from the the community park, which was West Manor Recreation. And, you know, I wasn't, you know, I was never that far away. But I do remember that time of where I was far enough where I could hear my mother calling, you know, just like the song, I can hear my mother calling.
Yeah, Cosmic Slop.
I could hear her. Yeah, I could hear her calling. And so I was that close, relatively close. And so everything went up there, whether it was just kind of community, you know, JV, Little League football and stuff like that. So all of the activities were right at the end of the street, which was safeguarding, you know, for me in that time. But, you know, I remember being in elementary school and them having the coloring books about, you know, not taking candy from strangers and, you know, this, that, or the third. And I remember the song that was is synonymous with that subconscious time in my life is Jesus Is Love by the Commodores.
By the Commodores, yeah.
I would hear that song all of the time, and it gives me the chills to say it because, you know, it was just a frightening time. You know what I mean?
So when you hear it now, that's what you think of?
That's what I think about.
Is it weird to see it resurfacing in so many ways now? HBO has a special. Mindhunters did a whole season on it. Like
I watched it. I watched the documentary. What's my man's name? Will Packard, the one that they did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I watched it, and it was, you know, it was, you know, definitely informative. You know, not to be able to look back on the, you know, the experience as an adult. You know, I mean, it's kind of. It's really sobering to look back on it now. It was surreal as a child because we were terrified and we just didn't really know where this evil, you know, what corner it would come from, or, you know, what it would jump out from behind. So, you know, everybody was being careful, and I just remember that being, you know, just a time of just a closeness and togetherness and just trying to be protective of one another. You know what I mean? But.
Slight confession, anytime it's weird you mentioned the Commodores, because whenever they would show Wayne Williams, I'd always think of Walter Clyde Orange, the drummer from the Commodores.
That's right.
I'm going to hell for that one.
You're not.
Wayne Williams had those.
Still with us? Walter?
It was the glasses. It was the glasses, man.
Yeah.
They resembled each other. Damn, you're right.
Yeah.
And it's crazy because Goody Mob's manager, her name's Lakeisha Orange. That's her uncle.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
What?
That is true. It's a true story.
Damn. Was Goody Mob your first musical venture, or like did you have other groups growing up in Atlanta?
Yeah, I had one other group before Goody Mob. I had I was in a crew called the GA Style. With my man Ali Al, who was from Jersey, my man DJ Wynn, who passed away some years ago. Rest in peace, DJ Wynn, just recently had a birthday. His cousin Q, and DJ Will, got to shout him out, Sugar Bear. But we were just kind of, you know, in Atlanta, we had the temporary service agencies of where you can just kind of sign up and be a part of their roster. And they would call you kind of randomly, you know, on any given morning and be like, hey, are you available for work at this warehouse or this, that, or the third? I mean, like,
manpower.
So we would, yeah. So
manpower,
we would all,
yeah.
Yeah. So we would all, you know, get jobs together and, you know, pool money together. Like, so that was my first support system. They were all older than me. I've always been, you know, the youngest in any crew that I've been in. So Ali Al ended up, marrying my sister and, you know, having two beautiful daughters, my nieces. And so, like, you know, they were family, and they were kind of really looking out for me, because around that time I was really at risk youth, man. I was getting into a lot of trouble, and, you know, they really gave me some structure. You know what I mean? Because they were straight laced guys, you know what I'm saying? Like, no drinking, no smoking, just to working back and putting money together to, you know, buy studio time and just doing it the real way. You know what I mean? So, I owe a lot of debt of gratitude to them, because they really gave me quite a bit of my moral fiber.
How deep was or how strong was the first wave? I mean, I consider the LaFace era the second wave of Atlanta's, or maybe the beginning being Bobby Brown moving to Atlanta, but
before the Olympics, like post Olympics, it felt like is when stuff started.
Well, I mean, Bobby moved there in, I think, in 88, 89. And I thought, that's weird. Like, why would he not go to Hollywood like everyone else? So,
right.
I mean, but, you know, I knew like people, Bryson moved down there. I knew like certain people knew something about Atlanta that the rest of the world didn't know. But like how prominent, I mean, besides Brick, like how prominent was the music industry in Atlanta in your teen years?
Well, we definitely knew of Brick, Jimmy Brown from Brick, who's playing that
Sleepy's dad.
That's Sleepy Brown's dad, yeah. You know, playing that mm-hmm. iconic flute solo on Daz.
Right.
You know what I mean? So we knew about Brick and we knew about Cameo, the SOS band, Princess of Starbreeze, who ends up being Miss Deborah Killings, who's ended up doing all of the background work for TLC and played mm-hmm. bass on so many other, you know, famous records.
That's right. She is playing bass on Elevators, I think.
That's right.
That's her playing baseball.
So, Songs the ship.
Okay. Yep. So, you know, on the rap side, you know what I mean? Like we had MC Shy D who was from New York, but he's like the first like breakout dude. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, but there was, you know, only a other couple of rap sensations that came out of Atlanta around that time. So it was just mainly about the funk and soul bands of that time. And I think maybe would have attracted Bobby Brown to Atlanta. It probably was Deion Sanders or something like that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know, I guess Larry Blackmun did produce his first record.
That's right. He produced his first record.
The King of Stage, yeah.
Yeah. So maybe he came to Atlanta to work with Larry. Larry, of course, was a mentor of mine. Now I talk to him all of the time. Me and him just had birthdays recently. So yeah, I talk to him all of the time.
Lives out. How's he still doing, man? He's still cool. How's he doing?
He's good, man. He's really easygoing. Just like a soft spoken OG. He's, you know, he's just done a lot. You know what I mean? And it's a lot of love whenever I talk to him because I can quote him so well. You know what I mean? I just feel like, yo, like, let me just love on him. You know what I mean? And, you know, at one point, I had introduced him to my management firm, Primary Way, and they were representing the group for a short while and trying to help them, you know, get their ownership and their masters back and stuff like that, you know. But, you know, we befriended each other throughout that time. He's just a great all around guy, talented. Just an unsung individual, so talented, man.
Do they still touch the stage? Does Cameo? Do they still? Damn.
Yeah, I think they still tour. I'm not sure how extensively now, but I know like a few years back they were still moving around, and they actually, you know, so this would be 5 years ago because at my 40th birthday, they were a surprise guest performance for me at my 40th birthday. So everybody came out, you know, and did all of the greats.
Okay.
I used to love Alligator Woman. Y'all know that record?
Alligator Woman. Oh, yeah. That was the one with Vanity on the cover. Vanity's on the cover.
Alligator Woman. You know, I didn't really know what that was. I was like, what kind of music is this?
You know, only you and D'Angelo love that song, man.
Right.
Flirt was my joint, but they always go, Alligator Woman. It's like their little sort of new wave nod. They're nod to New Wave.
Yeah, I think it definitely was a nod to New Wave. I mean, like, you know, because I end up overhearing some conversations. Maybe I watched the interview with Rick James, and he was basically saying that Super Freak was inspired by Devo's Whip It. I mean, like, so I think mm-hmm. everybody was trying to cash in on that just a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, what? Can you put together or properly put in context how the Dungeon Family gets built? Like, instead of just asking, like, how did Goody Mob form, how did the entire collective become that? Or was it just a mythical marketing thing? Or, like,
no,
were you guys teenagers in the beginning and then had a plan to?
Well, at the time, Rico Wade and Sleepy Brown were a part of a dance troupe called Guess. And the dance troupes were the superstars in the city at that time because, you know, all of the high schools had different talent shows. So it's basically going around like on a promo tour, you know what I mean, in the city. So they were kind of, you know, locally celebrated, you know, because, you know, they were one of the more famous ones. It's them, the Stray Cats, you know what I mean? Like, which was a gang of, I was part of the Stray Cats, like a gang of, you guys familiar with Young Dro from Atlanta?
Yes. Yes. Come on. I know Dro.
Okay, so y'all know how Dro dressed. Dresses like he grew up in, you know, like he's a part of a golf community or something like that. Like
straight, real preppy.
He's basically kinda like super prep. So like it's like the Atlanta version of the lowlifes in New York. You know what I mean?
Ah, gotcha.
Thurston Howell and them boys. Yeah, you know what I'm saying? Yeah, so we was on it real hard like that in Atlanta too. So like tree torns and Benetton bags and tennis rackets and stuff like that.
Tree torns. Yeah. Wow.
Yo, I just had on a pair of tree torns the other day, man. Like, but anyway.
They still make them?
They still make them.
Because Dre, he had his own line. He just released a year or so ago.
Yeah, he did a line with them. Yeah.
Oh, damn.
So I got a couple of boxes, you know, courtesy of the homie. to answer the question, so yeah, so everybody knew them, and then they were also a part of an R&B crew called the U-Boys. So it was Sleepy Brown, Rico Wade, Mr. DJ, who ended up being the DJ for Outkast, yeah. He's Rico's cousin, and Marquez Etheridge, who ended up writing Waterfalls.
Yeah.
So they were a group called the U-Boys, and I remember I had gotten expelled from the Atlanta public school system. So I couldn't even go to school in Atlanta. So I had to be taken away to Gainesville, Georgia, and I went to Riverside Military Academy. I was something else as a kid.
What they expel you for?
Like, I'm gonna come back to that.
What they expel you for?
I'm just troublesome, man. I don't know, bro.
Yes, like, you do. That's the whole school system.
That's a lot of whoopee cushions under the system, right?
Like, you ain't no class clown. That's beyond.
I was just getting so much trouble. I don't know what was wrong with me at that time, but yeah. So I came back and I had to go to Frank McLaren Alternative School, which was a school for dropouts. And so me and Andre 3000 were classmates in the third grade. So we went to elementary school together and we were play cousins. So we were really close. He's like my brother when we were babies, pretty much. And so I ended up coming back to Atlanta, enrolling in Frank McLaren Alternative School, which was across the railroad tracks from Tri-Cities. So, which is where he had dropped out of school. So we both were dropouts and we were going, trying to get that GED. And that's when we reconnected after not having seen each other for years. Okay. So I saw a U-Boys picture there. It was like, you know, how you might see something. They may have been passing out those black and white, you know, groups, you know, where they got the managerial information.
Yeah, like the promo picture, the black and white.
So it was that, but it was on the ground. And I just recognized, you know, I recognized Sleepy Brown from dancing in the talent shows, because they were famous. They were like the hottest ones around for a long time. So he always had a look about himself. I'm like, I recognize him. And I recognize Marquez Etheridge too. So I saw that. Me and Dre hooked back up. That's that. I introduced him to DJ Wynn and DJ Alley, and I tried to get them to be a part of the GA style. And we went over and we did some little, you know, they did their first demo with DJ Wynn. That, you know, that didn't work. Then I remember one day they came back up to school with some look. And then he introduced me to, the day he introduced me to Big Boy is when I took them to meet DJ Wynn. So they took the train over there. They came up to the school. We all rode the train to DJ Wynn's. And that's that. But like shortly after that, they came back and it was like, yo, we met these dudes, and he was talking about Organized Noise. He's like, yo, he said, yo, dude is cool, but man, these dudes, boy, they got some fucking, you know what I mean? They got some heat, you know? So then, you know,
what year is this?
This is like 91, 92.
Okay.
I don't know. I guess what year did Dos Effects come out? Like 92?
91.
Yeah, 91. That was Dead Serious.
91.
Yeah. All right. So that
why was that your marker, CeeLo?
Because that's what we was on. I mean, like, you know, that would, I mean, it was Dos Effects for me and Dre. It was Dos Effects. It was Leaders of the New School. I forgot who else may have been rocking at that time.
Souls, you know what I mean? But, was Souls a big influence? I definitely heard that influence of Outkast. Yeah.
Souls and Mister, come on, Tajay, OVO, you know what I'm saying? Like the homeboys, you know, Domino, Casual.
So there was definitely an openness to, well, I guess there wasn't territorial markings until 93, 94, but.
Yeah, we look at it
before
like
before then, you were open to anything.
Nah, in the open. South, we had to study everything, man. That's super why, like, open. We had to study, yeah.
Yeah, we loved it. You know what I'm saying? We loved it. So basically, I'm trying to narrow the story down. Okay, so a good friend of mine, Pretty Ken ended up being a good friend of mine, and he ended up, you know.
That's your new name, Bill. Pretty Ken.
My nigga, Pretty Ken. You.
I'll take that.
That's right. So,
I always
so
wondered who he was because you shouted him out in the goodie bag verse. I was like, who is Pretty Ken? That's a great name.
So Pretty Ken and my cousin, Floaty, they ended up creating the Attic Crew. Now, me and Ken were like kindred spirits. And when I was introduced to Organized Noise, you know, he was like my role dog. I was living with Ken at the time.
Oh, wow.
So, like, we went over there together. But our tones, our voice, personalities, you know, swagger, the whole thing. We were bosom buddies. So, like, they just, you know, they took to me a little bit more and wanted to work with me. And they just felt like me and Ken were too similar. So, you know, he ended up starting the Attic Crew, which would give you Jim Crow, Polo the Don, the Young Bloods, and that whole movement.
Okay.
So that's Pretty Ken. But his cousin, Fat Keith, was a friend of mine.
That's you, Bill. That's your new name, Fat Keith.
I'll take that shit too.
I'm giving you all these names.
I'm down.
So me and Fat Keith were at Greenbrier Mall, right? So we're walking past, you know, the door about to leave out. There's like 10 payphones in a row. There's this dude standing there with his back to us. Keith recognizes him, and he taps him on the shoulder, and it's Marquez Etheridge. And then I recognize him from the picture. I said, because, you know, I got like a photographic memory down there. So I'm like, oh, okay, that's the homeboy from that picture I saw, like, you know, or whatever. So he said, yo, my homeboy sing, and he can rap. You should check him out. You know what I'm saying? So I went outside with him, and I sang for him. I rapped for him. And he said, well, I was actually on the phone trying to call over to the dungeon. He said, I know that they're there, but, you know, maybe the music's up too loud or something. And Keith was like, we'll take you over there. Where is it? He was like, yo, it's like, you know, 166, you know what I mean? Like, which is the expressway, you know, over by the fairgrounds. I said, we know, it's, you know, it's like 10 minutes up the road. So he jumps in the truck with us. I go over to the dungeon, and I'm leaving out one part. One time, so after Dre and Big introduced, and the thing didn't work out with DJ Wynn. They came back one day and said, man, like, we about to do a showcase for the Face Records. They had on the Face Records t-shirts, and they both had blonde hair. They had blonde, short blonde haircuts, and they were calling themselves Two Shades Deep at the time. So Dre's original rap name was Jazz, J-A-H-Z, Jazz. And Big Boy's, you know, given name is Antoine, so it was Jazz Antoine. So, so you know,
they both had blonde hair.
I don't even know what their vibe was.
That sounds like a different kind of
blonde hair. Do y'all remember? Do you remember Dallas Austin's first group, Highland Place Mobsters?
Highland Place Mobsters. Yeah.
Let's Get Naked. Yes.
Okay, Let's Get Naked. So you remember Chip Maniac?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay, me and Chip were like play brothers too. So people thought we looked alike. You know what I mean? But like Chip is like, he was just like me. He like a real fool. And that's why he got his nickname, Maniac. You know what I'm saying? Like
you can call me that too.
So all right, but he was talented. I'll do it. he's a really talented guy. Just you know, just one of those over the top, one of those tortured soul type, you know, tragedy cases, man. You know, like a good guy though, loving to death. But anyway,
A
small community in Atlanta. So I got to say this part. So Fat Keith takes us over to the dungeon. I'm recalling the conversation from Dre and Big the day that they said they were going to get signed to the Face. So we go over to the dungeon. Sleepy Brown sitting there. I recognize him from the U Boys picture. I sang for him. He's like, ooh, okay, cool, I like it. Then here comes Rico walking in the door with Dre and Big. They had just stepped out to go and get something to eat. Dre, you know, with excitement say, that's my dude, that's what I was telling you about, that's CeeLo. He's the one that does all of the story raps. because at that time, you know, I rhyme like that. Like I was on some, you know, Slick Rick. That was Slick my Rick guy. Story, you know what I'm saying? You know. So anyway, that's it. So I sang again for Rico. And then, you know, we ended up, you know, reconnecting and blah, blah, blah. I left that night. And then two other homeboys of mine, this is like months later, Big JD and Killer B, two of the homie hustlers from high school. You could tell they was getting money in high school. You know, he had that black Grand Jeep Cherokee with the gold package and the BBSs. You know what I mean? Like
the BBSs
in high school.
In high school, like you remember the one Heavy D? It's the one Heavy D pulled up in the self destruction video. He had a red one. Yeah. I don't know if y'all recall that.
Damn, I remember that.
So anyway, so they was managing me at the time. You know what I mean? Because they even though I knew them, they didn't know. Nobody knew I did music. Everybody knew me for getting into shit, and they're like, yo, go get Carlo, he'll do it. I was that kind of guy, you know. So we were at my homeboy Glenn Cook's house. I'm sorry, Chris. Let me just tell you.
No, we're nerding out over here.
Go in. No. Keep going. No, keep going.
I'm more amazed that you were Debo in this situation. I'm thinking like
I was, man.
Like that's
I
how
was Debo. Know,
like,
it's
Prince B out this motherfucker, like
from the flower child. The district, school. The district, the whole district.
Quest, I was Debo, like that whole, you know, robbing motherfuckers for starter jackets and stuff like that. That was me. That's what
okay,
I did.
Okay, now it's coming. All right, thank you.
Here we go. Tales so, from
wait
the
left. Because
it's true. No music. Totally. Save my life, man. You know what I mean?
Well, wait, because this is weird. All right, wait. I just gotta preface. Because the thing is, my favorite verse you ever did on Still Standing, the gutter butter voice.
We gave up gutter butter. Yeah, we gave up
right,
the car.
Gutter butter. And in my mind, I'm like, oh, that CeeLo could tell a tall tale. Like, ain't about that life, but damn, you sure play it well. Motherfucker, you really is living this life.
No, dude. I'm telling you, Quest, if you just probably do just an interview with anybody else from Atlanta, they'll tell you. I don't really like to talk about it, man, but because I don't know. It's just, it's weird. It's
I do
just too
time,
long
CeeLo, not my...
I know.
You've so, been okay, blessed, so I, man. Jesus.
No, definitely. Most definitely. So listen, I don't want to lose it. So okay, I battled Cujo. Cujo and Big Gip pulled up to our homie Glenn Cook's house. He was like, who's the guy from American Pie? Stifler.
Stifler's my
So Cook was like Stifler. He's the black Stifler of the other neighborhood. Like, you know, if there was he was the one that had the cut parties at his house. You could always go in at any point of the day, somebody was there. You know, just bring some beer and a you know, so that's when we were still going in dollars a piece on nickel bags of weed and, you know, just broke stuff, broke hood shit. You know what I'm saying? Buying, you know, we couldn't even afford to buy the whole pack of Newports. Just go get four Newports. Like,
oh, y'all buying the Lucy's. Y'all buying Lucy's.
Wow. Lucy's and Deuce, Colt 45s, Old English. We were drinking 40 ounces. It was that era, man. Okay. I battled Cujo because Killer B, you know, I'll just say it because he was a weed guy at that time, but he ended up being my manager because they, you know, and so he played me Cujo and T-Mo's demo. So originally, they were the Goody Mob Lumberjacks, yeah. You know. And so I heard their demo, and I was like, damn, you know. I knew T-Mo because he grew up a street over from me. His family's house is a street over from my grandmother's house that I grew up. So I've known him my whole life, too. He's like the second person I've known the longest. Him, Dre, and then Backbone. I've known them all my life. You know, so anyway, I used to hear about Willie. I heard about his legend. Willie Cujo, the girls call him, he was voted most attractive. And, you know, my sister that would come home because she graduated in their class. So Cujo, T-Mo, and Gip graduated with my sister. So
right.
I'm 3 years older than them, but I knew. So, but Willie was just kind of like hunk of a dude, you know what I'm saying? You know, but he was like a brawler, like Patrick Swayze in Roadhouse. So like, you know, so around,
I know.
So, so around that time, it was about, it wasn't about gangs. It's most certainly about gangs in Atlanta now, but it wasn't about gangs. It was about rival high schools. So we grew up how like the movie Outsiders was. You know what I mean? You know, we fought in that same park that was at the end of my street. All of the high school fights would take it to the rec. That's what they called it. It was short for recreation center. Let's take it to the rec. So I've stood there and I witnessed a handful of high school brawls, battle royals. And, you know, but I was an underclassman. And, you know, I was really looking for my turn. So I was really making noise in my grade. And then I eventually started hanging with the older dudes and started going over there and getting into those fights and stuff like that. You know what I'm saying? So with that, Cook, I battled. So Killer B was selling us the weed, but he ended up being my manager. He became my manager because he witnessed me battle Cujo. You know what I mean? Like, and I'll say that it was a draw. You know what I mean? Like, you know, because it was friendly. You know what I'm saying? Like, but you know, I had the secret weapon. I started singing on him and all kind of shit. You know what I'm saying? It was like, damn. But you know, a lot of people like to give me the credit for being maybe one of the first to do that. You know what I'm saying? Like myself, Lauryn Hill. But I'm like, I'm going all the way back to Force and D's and UTFO, you know, Cold Crush and all of those routines they used to do with the Harmony. So anyway.
I was going to say, the one promo thing that I've ever missed in the history of Roots was when they went to a radio station. Do you remember this night?
Yes, we freestyled. You know, I remember.
Where all y'all freestyled together?
Who?
Yeah, Kamal.
It was Kamal,
Kamal
Tariq,
freestyle?
Malik.
Yeah,
it was. It's, Malik, it's on YouTube.
Get on.
I'll admit it now. I met a bad shorty in Atlanta. And
yeah, I feigned
sickness with the record label, like, oh man, I really got a headache. I can't make this. And they went to the radio. Like, normally I'll be the first to hop up.
Good for you.
A radio station interview. So
can I get on another 71 for a second? I used to love Distortion to Static. Do you know that? I mean, like, I got that. Maybe right before that, I think I got maybe like a promo copy of Do You Want More? You know what I'm saying? And I remember telling Tariq, and you know him, like, I say, like, yo, I really like the album, bro. He said, oh, yeah? What song you like? You know what I'm saying? You feel me? Like, he was kind of like...
always asked that. Like, stop asking people that.
So you know I'm not making it up, because I remember it like it was yesterday. And I said, oh, so I like, you know, Distortion Static, obviously. You know what I mean? Like, Proceed. And I said, like, and then I love Lazy Afternoon. He was like, oh, shit. You know what I'm saying?
You really know.
They ain't on the sampler.
And I think that was kind of like the beginning of a bond, because then we ultimately then end up doing one of our first tour together.
Y'all made such an impression. All I remember, we had spent a good 3 years just in isolation living in Europe. So when we finally came back to the States in 95, like, we didn't have friends yet. Like, there was no common D'Angelo. Like, there was none of that, like, the clique that we had. So we were just kind of out there in the open, and y'all were really the first people that we befriended. And, like, that shit meant a lot. Like, y'all came to that show. I think there was a show that we did with Far Side.
That's right.
And I think that you guys came as like an outdoor show at one of those spots.
The Masquerade, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. But yeah, no, you were always, that's how I know you're a hip hop head and into that. So how, once you guys got together, like, how, especially now, like, I can't even imagine how it is to navigate in a group. Like, how do you determine who does what and concepts and what you guys are?
Okay, so I'll cap it off by saying Killer B and JD started to manage me after they witnessed that battle. And then some months, and then they were trying to kind of show me that they were, you know, credible. You know, they came and picked me up one night, you know, and then they took me to Jermaine Dupri's house. And this is when they were shooting the video for Crisscross, Everything's All Right. It's the record they had
the with Super Cat. Cat. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So that was at Jermaine's house. And I remember that. And I said, okay, so we showing you things, we introducing you, exposing. I'm like, all right, you know, cool, whatever. You know. So then they ended up taking me to the dungeon again. And when we were pulling up on the dungeon, I said, this place looks familiar. So long story short, they brought me back to the dungeon and everybody was there. So I said, I've been here before. I go in the door, Dre, Big, Sleepy, everybody who I just met months prior, because of Fat Keith and Marquez, they were all there in addition to Gimp and T-Mo and everybody just pulling up. And it was just traffic over there. And I was like, wow, like this is like my whole neighborhood in this little bitty house. You know what I'm saying? So that's how the Dungeon Family came together. Now, as far as the song structure, I'll be totally what the system is, man. What happened was, with the success of Outkast, you know, everybody came in as individuals. Let's say, for example, Big Gip and Cool Breeze were in a group called the East Point Chain Gang. So Gip came over as a solo artist. Now, if you notice, Gip had always had, Gip was poised to be the next superstar. You know what I mean? Because, you know, Dirty South, which was the third single off of Soul Food, it featured him in Cool Breeze. He was just paying a respect to his OG. Cool Breeze is his OG, and Cool Breeze came up with he coined the phrase Dirty South. But technically, otherwise, that would have been a Gip solo song because right. It's Gip, Cool Breeze, and Big Boy. And then the second album, Black Ice, which was the second single.
Because you weren't on Black Ice, right?
Nobody was on it. It was just Gip, Big, and Dre. You know what I'm saying? So they were really looking for him to really be the next big thing. So with that being said, Goody Mob, you know, the Soul Food album was essentially intended to be a compilation album to get everybody out at the same time. So we weren't even formally a group. So if you go back to...
it's like the Ghetto Boys.
It's like
y'all just put together.
So yeah, if you basically, but it's kind of like the practicality of a Rico Wade and the vision of a Rico Wade, because, you know, let's say I was featured on Get Up, Get Out, you know, which was another Outkast song off of their album.
Yeah. They was on Call It a While.
And Cujo and T-Mo on Call It a While. Me and Big Gip were on Get Up, Get Out. Get Up, Get Out ended up being a single, but us being so totally ignorant and naive about radio format and song length, this song
like
9 minutes.
8 minutes.
Yeah. We didn't know. We really didn't know, right? So they had to put out an Outkast version and a Goody Mob version. So anyway, there was some interest in me as a solo artist, but I was kind of new over to the dungeon. So it would have been wrong. And to be totally honest, I can say that I wasn't prepared to be a solo artist, but they wanted to give me a solo deal. You know what I mean? So I was all up to get in a group with the homeboys that I had known from the neighborhood. You know what I mean? Like, so that's what Goody Mob, I said, this is easy enough. I know the homeboys. So, but you know, I'm the baby of that group. I tend to be more vocal than just about everybody. So people kind of like misconstrue that, but like, nah, everybody's older than me. You know what I mean?
What's the age difference?
Like 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that could be shit. In hip hop,
that's a lot. Yeah, in hip hop,
it does make a difference. To me too, now it makes sense because I went to Clark. By the time all this was happening, I was at CAU, and I used to see CeeLo on Spelman campus and stuff all the time, just like chilling because that's what people did.
You used to see me down there in the Impala.
Yeah, like sitting on the wall.
That's it. Yeah, I was down there.
Because I was like, I wanted you to talk about, like, so you talked about the beginnings of how y'all all got together. But by the time I got to Atlanta, it was a scene that was being set that was like no other pre, like, Black Lily, like with you guys, Funk Jet.
Well, go ahead. I'm telling y'all, because, like, you know, Spike Lee filmed School Days there. So it's like, you know, the AU, that was popping. So that was almost like, that was like the strip. You know what I mean? Like if you had a nice whip or something like that, you ride through there, you know, hollering at the college girls and this, that, and the third. So like, it was just this little vicinity, you know what I mean? Like, you know, of just like socialization, right. You know what I mean? and it's like right next to the hood. So it's like, so
like you can all get
whatever you want at the AU.
All HBCUs.
Yeah. You can they get your film and Clark. All. And we still had Morris Brown at the time.
But so look, no, your question, answer your question. I want to make sure that I'm clear. All right. Yes. So with that being said, I'm like I write songs like playwrights, like screenplays. You know what I mean? So like I have to have a visual, I mean, like something to anchor me down. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, okay, like we're talking about this, we're talking about that, and then I know how to summarize and I know how to paraphrase. But you got artists like, you know, Cujo, who, you know, this, and I mean this with the utmost respect, he's like fucking Hannibal Lecter, you know, man, where he could take his, when I first met Cujo, we would go to the liquor store, have a 40 ounce of Old English, he would finish the 40 and take the brown paper bag and write a rhyme on the paper bag. Or wow. I saw him write rhymes on a roll of toilet tissue. So he would do really cool, you know, swaggeristic, eccentric shit like that, which made everybody be like, taking a notice to, you know, like this big Cujo. You know what I mean? So, I thought that kind of stuff was amazing. You know what I mean?
Member know what their role was in the group or how they were perceived?
Well, I'm kind of like that. I was kind of like project manager. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I came up with the concept of the soul food. I came up with that title. I came up with the concept of, you know, Cujo being the meat because things that he was saying was kind of tough to chew. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, right. Timo was the bread because Timo was this kind of like independent dude. You know what I'm saying? Like, but man cannot live off bread alone. And Gip was the vegetables because Gip is like, you know, this politician. He knows how to, you know, wrangle and galvanize and get people together. And like, you know, and I'm like the water because I'm there to be the transparency and the clarification, because everybody was trying to, you know, interject with new slang and, you know, it was a whole new identity. And even I didn't understand what some of what was being said. So I kind of like assumed the position to just make sure that we were translating, you know, the right way, because I knew what we were doing was important. You know what I'm saying? You feel me? And it was imperative that, you know, like we were received, you know, and seen in the right light. You know what I mean? So that's kind of like me. I'm still like that to this day. But, you know, it's hard to know a lot without being seen as a know-it-all. Can you dig it?
Really?
I can be a little controlling, but it's always about the quality control. You know what I mean? Right.
As long as you know.
Yeah, I know. And it ends up being a nuisance a little bit, but like, it's for the greater good. You know what I mean? Like, just trying to make sure that we good. You know
we appreciate the end product.
So. See, Quest, that's what you got to be for the, you know what I mean? I know that. I know you can relate to that.
I was going to say, I kind of caught a little hell on the internet about a month or so ago.
Uh-oh.
I did an interview. Me and Pooh, we did an interview with my man, Pizzo, out of Hip Hop Site out of Vegas. Well, we just were naming our favorite records and they would play the records. You know what I'm saying? We talk about it. And so one of the records that Pooh named was ATLians. And so he brought up ATLians and we were talking about it, whatever. And they got on me because I said, well, now is it time to admit, and you don't have to weigh in on this, CeeLo, but this was just my thought. Can we admit now that Soul Food was a better album than ATLians?
Ooh.
Oh my God. Woo! Boy, niggas was hot.
Jason just left the room. Okay.
Right.
And
what I want to tell you, man, like specifically just to you as an MC, you know, and let me be clear, I love ATL. I mean, that's a classic fucking record. Like, I love that album. But for me, the way I came into Goody Mob, when I bought that album, first off, and I've told this story show before, like, I actually broke the law to, like, get y'all's album. Like, I drove, I ain't have no license. I'm driving to the rec store to buy soul food. So I bought it, you know, man. So like when I first heard Cell Therapy, that was kind of weird. I was like, okay, I like this. It's kind of weird. And then the B-sides, we had the single first, and the B-side was Soul Food on like the CD, you know. Single.
Yeah.
And so you had like Soul Food, and I was like, okay, like they sing. I was like, okay. But then when I heard when that shit opened up, with you singing and then going into thought process, I just thought that was just such a great, like, to open an album on such, like, a, because most rap albums always started with, like, the hype, the just hitting you over the head.
Right.
But that shit to just go into something just so, like, slow and meditate, like, that shit was fucking haunting, bro. I was like, yo, this record, these niggas has got it.
I will double down and say that the day I got the CD, Free was so...
I need a reminding. I'm sorry.
Free was so, to me, it was so, I was so jealous that we didn't create some shit like that. I think I spent a day listening to Free on loop before I even got Pat. By day two, then I went to thought process, like the whole rest of the record. But to me, oh man.
That album, that shit, setting it off like that was amazing. And so the thing for me was when I heard Soul Food, that was for me just as an MC, I'd never heard anybody be that honest.
Like,
sometimes I don't even know how I'm gonna eat about $20 away from being on the street. I'm like, damn, these niggas is really spitting that shit. And then like your verse on Guess Who, like talking about your mom.
Yeah.
And just, you know what I mean? Like, so when I heard Soul Food, I mean, by the time ATLians came around, I mean, I liked ATLians, but the initial punch, it kind of felt like y'all had beat them to the punch in terms of what I was looking for in the next Outkast album. Just the soul, the honesty, just everything. Y'all kind of beat them to the punch for me.
Well, to be totally honest, I will say this. Outkast has always been our flagship as far as Dungeon Family is concerned, you know, but we had always been fundamentalist, you know, and an even more effective, example is, I've described it as this. If Dre and Big were Chuck and Flav, we were the S1Ws.
Yes, yes.
You know what I'm saying?
100%.
And that's the relationship. You know what I mean? Like, even though me, Big, and Dre are the same age, you know, and I was supposed to be an Outkast originally.
Wow.
Can you believe that? Yeah. Yeah.
That went crazy. How hard is it to sell this concept and this idea in your own hometown? Because image-wise, you guys aren't what an outsider's view would think of as traditional Atlanta hip hop.
Not at all.
And yet you are, I mean, you're actually establishing it. Like, how open was the Atlanta natives into this concept? Was it like, you guys are weirdos? Or was it like, I feel that shit too.
I'll say this. We were like the Zulu Nation. You know what I mean? Like, let's say when you know that Afrika Bambaataa, you know what I mean, and the Soul Sonic Force were the Black Spades just prior. You know what I mean? You feel me? Mm-hmm. It was kind of like that. It's like, you know, everybody realized that we were using the opportunity for a greater good. We were not relishing in, you know, any of the wrongs that we were, you know, that we had done, you know, and that people knew and could have attested to, like, you know what I mean? You know, it's like, damn, like, you know, like, if anything, we caught people by surprise because we were addressing certain issues topically, trivially, you know what I mean? Like, you know, just trying to expound upon who we were, you know, like, as artists and as individuals, as men, as Black men, as activists, because I always say that we were fighting for the civil rights of Southern hip hop at that time. You know what I mean? And, you know, we recorded Soul Food in Curtis Mayfield's home studio. So our icons, you know what I mean? Like, they were alive and well, and we knew that they were watching. And we knew that we needed to do something with some reverence and some respect.
Were you one of the writers on the, did you say Curtis Mayfield, on the New World Order album, the one, did you co-write one of those records?
No, I didn't, but some of the stuff that I wrote, it didn't really make it, but I was working at the time with the OG Kool Ace, You know what I mean? Yeah, you feel me? You remember?
Yeah, yeah.
So for those, I got to shout out Cool Ace, man. Cool Ace.
Who's Cool Ace?
Cool Ace.
That's your new nickname, Bill.
Cool Ace was Gip's lieutenant in the Nation of Islam early. So, but then he digressed and he became a bona fide pimp.
Oh, okay, yeah, that happened.
Wait, how are you so open to that? Like, he was just like, and then he said, pimp. Yeah, oh, okay, it makes sense.
Like, I wanted to see, you know, ordinary to CeeLo. I just wanted, you know, that's normal.
So cool, but he's super duper duper talented. And I love Ace. He's a good guy. You know what I mean?
Do you think
he's still around? He's still alive?
He's still around. He's like, he's one of those dudes like, you know, he hosts the amateur nights at the strip clubs and stuff like that. That's his thing. But that's, you know, and that's not to even be condescending. That's where he want to be. That's his community. You know, it's like, that's where he loved. That's where he loved to love. And that's where he want to be.
You think that since you guys came out in such a, because Atlanta also is such like a large college town, not just in a sense of like the AUC, but all this, the colleges there, do you think that attributed to some of the extra advantage that you had at home?
It did. And everybody was at that time because I OutKast struck an accord because it had given Atlanta an identity. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, Kangols and, you know, Guess jean shorts and pom-pom footies and Stan Smith. I don't know if y'all know what I'm saying.
Yes. Like,
you
know what I mean? I know what you're saying. Yeah,
okay. So it was, that's how we dressed in Atlanta. You know what I mean? So they hit the nail on the head with the imaging. But, you know, we represented like an underbelly. You know what I mean? Like, you know, and an attitude, you know what I mean? Like, and an aggression, I mean, and a progression, you know, because again, we felt like we knew that we were in some regard, like frontlining. I mean, like, you know, for Southern hip hop to be counted, to be heard and to be respected. And so, you know, I believe that Cell Therapy, it won with Atlanta because it won with New York first. You know what I mean? That's the record that got us into the tunnel and stuff like that. You know what I mean? Like, and we out there, you know, freestyling with the boot camp clique. And, you know, as I got to get to meet all of them early, you know, Ruck and Sean Price and, you know, Strange Wonder, you know what I mean? Like,
I was going to ask if you had any opinion or reservations about New York post that Source moment for OutKast where the South had something to say.
To be totally honest, can I tell you what I was distracted by? I heard the boos, but I wasn't really tripping off of it, man. Like, it was like suspended animation on that evening. You know, there was a lot of tension because of the East Coast, West Coast thing, but us being neutral and us being acknowledged, you know, enough to even have been there and been in the building, I was kind of riding high on that. I had gotten some outfit tailor-made for it, you know what I'm saying? And I'm gonna tell you something else that's really cool. Biggie Smalls was one of our first supporters, you know what I mean? Like, he championed us, you know, from the inception and off the top. Biggie Smalls' first shows were opening up for us in Atlanta. You know what I mean? Puffy shot and directed Players Ball.
He did Players Ball, yeah.
For OutKast. So we all started together. I almost signed to Bad Boy.
What?
Andre Harrell was my mentor. You know what I mean? Like, and has been. Like, you know, so rest his soul. So with that, I still remember vividly when we were walking up on that stage, I heard the boos in my peripheral kind of hearing, but I got distracted by the sound of Big's voice sitting right there on the front row saying, yeah, yo, CeeLo, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Hollering at me, you know, and showing us love and letting us know that he rocking with us. And I remember Outkast's first show in New York, we all went together as a crew. And we were performing, I think it was, do y'all remember somebody named called Grandma Funk?
Oh my God.
Grandma Funk, G-R-A-M-M-A, I think
that's
I remember.
That's what I'm calling you. That's your nickname, man.
Oh, okay. Damn, you pulled a blast from the past. Grandma Funk.
Who's up there for Grandma Funk, bro?
Ah, damn.
So Big came out.
And I'm Big, old, man.
Big showed me love because Big was right there in front of the stage rapping every word to Get Up, Get Out with me. You know what I'm saying? He showed me a lot of love. He showed me a lot of love. He even invited me to be on Ready to Die. I don't really know what ever happened with that. You know what I'm saying? Like, but I was completely naive and new to the game. I didn't even know what he was talking about because I didn't really know how to receive it or even appreciate the invite because Big wasn't Big at that time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know what I mean?
Oh, he wasn't Big.
Yeah, this was, but he was just still recording Ready to Die. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this like Party and Bullshit. Who's the Man soundtrack?
Who's the Man, right? Soundtrack, Now, my Ready to Die was a slow burn, man. It wasn't like a record that just did big numbers out the gate. Like,
you're
it took a minute.
Right. Yeah. You're absolutely right. You know what I mean? Like, because I didn't even really like Party and Bullshit all of the way. Like, I liked the House of Pain record off that soundtrack.
Right.
Oh, it was Who's the Man.
Oh, that's the Who's the Man. Oh,
Who's the Man.
Okay. Yep, because I was into Cypress Hill around that time.
DJ Muggs,
DJ Muggs. So Assassin, what's up? It's safe.
Oh yeah, that joint, cause y'all did a record on the, I love that record y'all did on the Soul Assassin joint. I love that record.
Cypress Hill, them the first homies that took us in when we went to LA. So we all got tatted from Cartoon, you know what I mean? Like,
okay.
That's why we be really down with the brown and black, you know what I'm saying? Like making sure we keep the peace and we advocates of that cause they showed us nothing but love, man. Be Real just did a song recently with Cujo on one of his independent projects. So the love is still there. It's remained, man, almost 30 years.
Man, it was a producer y'all had on Soul Food that I never saw on anything else. Mixo.
His name's Mixo.
What's the deal with him?
Dude, well, you know, we're in the process of doing another Goody Mob album right now as we speak, actually. And it's funny that Quest even asked that question of how we get songs done. And it's, you know, it's tedious, you know what I'm saying? You know, because like, you know, we're older, you know what I'm saying? Like, everybody's entitled, you know what I mean? Like, you feel me? But it's always been that kind of combustible kind of thing, you know what I mean? Like, you know, but Mixo was, he was Cujo and Timo's original producer. So he was producing the Lumberjacks.
Okay.
And, you know, they had other couple of dope songs that was supposed to make the album, but they were in a legal suit with their former management and they couldn't use that material. So, you know, everybody just wanted to honor Mixo because of that sound. And I just spoke to him the other day. I said, man, dude, you're the only other producer besides Organized Noise who made that original one, the OG.
Straight up.
I said, so therefore, you know, because I bumped into him and I was like, yo, man, we got to get on the same page, man. I got to get you back in the mix, man. Like, it's only right that we acknowledge you. And he was dope. I mean, like, his stuff will remind you of RZA, all dark and dusty and like just dope. I mean, like, you know, so, you know, big Wu-Tang fan over here too. And people liking us to the Southern Wu-Tang and all of that.
P.S. I just pretty thought of much. Something, y'all. We need to put a bookmark on when the Goody Mob album comes out because CeeLo, you don't know this, but we have been planning a trip to Atlanta to just grab everybody. For Questlove Supreme, like we was gonna go see Rico, we was gonna see Drama, we was just gonna see everybody. But you know, considering the time, I'm like, well, maybe when that album comes out, we'll all be able to come out the house and get the whole goodie. That would be dope.
We'll be
if
off
y'all
punishment.
Want to.
And touring with that record, which is the first time that we toured together, explain that process because you guys used a band, you guys used, Joy was singing with y'all at that point, like,
yep.
You guys had Little John and the Chronicle as your band. Like, were you guys always presented in kind of like I saw y'all as almost like new P-Funk?
Yeah,
how y'all put it together.
That's funny that you said that. Well, we got introduced to Little John and the Chronicle because we did a listening party or a release party. At a club called Kaya back then in Atlanta.
Yes, Frank Ski. Sorry.
You know what I'm saying? Shouts out to Frank Ski. And the Chronicle was the band. And it just kind of went over so well. you know, it just, I'm sure that there was management that suggested it at that time, you know, that we kind of go in the live direction. And that was all good. And then, you know, George Clinton, speaking of Parliament, he was one of our earlier mentors and supporters too. He's the one that christened the Dungeon family as the Young Parliament Funkadelic. So when you start seeing us breaking out with all of the outfits and stuff like that, it came from him. You know what I'm saying? Because he said you can't just say you're too exceptional. You have to be exceptional. That's why they call it a fashion statement. If you can speak there, then you can say less. You know what I'm saying?
Shit. Okay. Yeah.
I love it.
And we went, and obviously we went wild with that.
As you should have. Yeah,
of course.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. Now,
we learned from that.
Oh, I was going to say for your the second album, for Still Standing, what happened with, well, I got a lot of questions about that album. So They Don't Dance No More. I love that fucking song. Mm-hmm. What happened with Lil Will?
Okay, so They Don't Dance, the version that you hear is a replay, but the original version was done with the sample of Aerosmith's Dream On.
Oh, so wow.
So that's what that is. It's really Dream On, right? So Lil Will was a hoodster, you know what I mean? Like, you know, around Atlanta, super duper talented. You know what I mean? Like, great voice. And he was signed to Organized Noise's label imprint at Interscope, Organized Noise Records.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was just circumstance and inexperience that kind of overshadowed, I mean, like, all of the promise and potential that he had as an artist. But, like, I just saw him recently, maybe like a year ago. I had a birthday party out here. And he'll still hit my line every now and again, but like he's just a real one, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, yeah, yeah. You know, because he's that's him singing So Icy, you know, on Gucci Mane and Jeezy's first breakout record together, So Icy. That's Lil Will singing the record, singing the hook. So, you know, we responsible for a lot of careers, man. You know, like, and you know, he's forever Dungeon family.
On the record on Still Standing, the Just About Over,
Just About
the
Over
rock joint, was that David Wilde? Was that Wild Peach?
Yeah, that's David Wilde. That's David Wilde and Wild Peach. Rest in peace to Miss Peach.
Yeah, you know, and David is still around?
Yeah, David still. Whenever Big go out and he take the band, he take Peach and he take Deborah Killens with him. He's always kept them.
That's what's up.
He's so solid for that.
Well, you answered my gutter butter question, but also I remember like up in Philly, like Beautiful Skin was also it for every coffee shop joint I knew.
That's yeah. Right.
That wound up on their mixtapes. For World Party, what was the chemistry with you guys in the making of that album? That was different from the first two records.
Well, I tell you this, you know what I mean? Like, it's never a problem. You know, I can rhyme cat and hat, you know what I'm saying? You know, so like I can just still be, you know, I can just still come in and just do, you know, whatever we doing, you know what I'm saying? You know, but let me try to give it some poetic justice. You know, it's documented that I had a great disdain for that project because you know even though we were marginally successful at that point, you know, two consecutive gold records, you know, it's only right to me like that you want to go to the next natural progression and and shoot for a higher mark, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think, you know, and I know that was the ambition for the label, which is why for that third and project with them and final project with them, it's the one where they wanted to come in and interject with their opinion about direction, you know, and things.
The label
of that
did, LaFace did.
Yeah,
so
yeah, it was
can
like
I ask?
Label.
Can I ask? Was Get Rich to This the last song recorded for that record?
Yeah, yeah.
Good night, ladies and gentlemen.
It's
I did it again. Thank you.
It was. It definitely was. And I'm gonna tell you why. because it wasn't even our record. It was Backbone.
It was a Backbone joint. Yeah.
Wait, whoa, what?
For real? That's why Backbone's verse is first, and he's doing the hook. It was his record. It would have been a hit for him because Backbone is, you know, the Dungeon Family was comprised of, you know, teachers and philosophers and, you know, hustlers and killers. Right. Everybody, you know, all that shit came with it. Them say, you know, but, you know, he was, you know, Backbone is one of our real live bona fide hustlers that come out of the crew that really represent on the street side. You know what I mean? Like, and we needed that to make sure that all of the bases were covered. You know what I'm saying? So that would have been a great record for him just as a solo record, but it was so hot, or so we thought, you know what I mean, that, you know, it was Organized Noise's, you know, decision to say, hey, we're gonna take that record and then use the platform, you know, of Goody Mob, you know, to propel you for your solo effort shortly thereafter. You know what I'm saying? You feel me? But yeah, man, you know,
it didn't fit. Yeah, from the fan side, yeah.
It wasn't for people were so disappointed, and I knew it. I mean, like, if you want to go back and dig up any of those bones, you will see. I said it out loud. I was very plain. Yeah. I was very frank, you know, I mean, about my disconnect with it. I'm almost like, man, this is not what the people want. And hey, man, you know, like, but hey, if we win, then we win. And so you feel me? Like, if we don't, I'm gonna move on. And so you feel me?
But
like,
here's the thing though. Technically, I mean, the album went gold.
It did better. It sold more records than any of the other ones.
Damn. Than the other joints. Wow. Okay, so, and it still didn't feel like a win to you?
Well, but see, like, I guess at that time, Questman, really, bro, I wasn't even really money conscious or none of that. I wasn't tripping off none of that. I was just about trying to make history, and everything I was doing was for the glory. You know what I'm saying? That's how I saw it. I consider myself a real live revolutionary. You know what I mean? Like, you know, that's what I wanted to live and die for. You know what I'm saying? You feel me? It would have been an honor. You know what I mean? Like, so that was my logic. And now in retrospect, you know, sometimes I feel disappointed. I feel like, I don't know, I'm 45 years old, I survived. I mean, maybe I didn't cause enough damage or something. You know what I'm saying? Like, I feel like that. You know what I'm saying? Is that real for me to say?
No, that was starting when your career started with like cell therapy and shit.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? So like, I look around at what we're living through right now. I'm like, God damn. You know what I'm saying? Like,
Think that you make UA influence, and especially some of these young, you know, protesters and revolutionaries coming up, you don't think you the soundtrack today revolution?
Oh, most certainly. I've raised over 1,000 sons. I'm sure
that's
I
all have. I'm saying, right?
You know, and I'm proud of that. And now I'm a decorated soldier, you know, and higher ranking officer. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you know, so like I'm gracious and very humble. You know what I mean? But I'm just saying, like, it's just a passion. You know what I mean? But
yeah,
And you know, of course, I mean it on an artistic front. I mean, like, you know, that's how I mean it. You know what I mean? I just want to do that shit that lasts. I mean, like, you know, I don't want to do anything disposable or forgettable or whatever. So
yeah, records. I like the Dip. I thought like you as a producer, that was the one. I was like, yo, this is.
I thought so too. Now I tell you the truth about the Dip. T-Mo produced the Dip.
We were starting
to venture out, but no, like I came in and I did all of those string arrangements and stuff like that, and so yeah, we were growing, and so like I wanted all of that exuberant, you know what I mean, like over the top stuff that I ultimately went on to do. You know what I'm saying? You feel me? But like, you know, it's almost like people that start with you, you know, I hate to say it like this, but it's like people either want you to be or expect you to be like poor righteous teachers. And I'm not just talking about the group. I mean, literally, it's like,
I know what you mean.
But I'm like, but in my mind, I'm like, nah, like I'm too intelligent about music and about industry. It's like, I know better. You know what I'm saying? Like if you guys, and at that time, you know, Cash Money and No Limit Records, they were coming in and then they were showing how to, they outworked everybody. Their output, you know what I'm saying, like, was just immense. Like, you know, you couldn't really compete. The motherfuckers was dropping so much music. You know what I'm saying? Like, they dropped so much music.
They have, like, a double page in the source with all the albums coming out.
They're the ones that changed the lexicon to where you know, they dropped so much material that you couldn't even call it music anymore. That you had to call it content.
It was product, yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So we couldn't, you know, we were still trying to make opuses and stuff like that. So we were taking 2 and 3 years to make an album and shit like that. But like, no. So we really couldn't compete. And so I think everybody just felt a certain kind of way. Everybody just wanted to be competitive at the end of the day and show that we weren't this straight-laced, buttoned-up, you know, like quartet of squares or, you know what I mean? Like, you know, like that we were cool and we liked women and we, you know, we liked the party and other kind of stuff, which was true. Like, we some of the biggest parties out there.
It's like, yeah. But at the time, the earthy label was on folks too. It was like either you're earthy or you're shiny.
Yeah, you know what I mean? So...
Yep. Sorry. You knew it was coming. You guys knew it was coming. You knew I was going to interrupt this moment to say that's the conclusion of part one of our interview with CeeLo Green. We'll come back next week for part two of our interview with CeeLo Green. And trust me, part two, we really get into it. We get into everything. Where his life has been, lessons he's learned, journeys he's going to make, and basically... You know, we get into it. So please join us next week, ladies and gentlemen, for part two of our interview, the one and only legendary CeeLo Green. See you next week. Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.